Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cortese. This episode of Oncology on the Go was repurposed from a Cancer Network-organized X-Space hosted by Nicholas J. Hornstein of the Donald and Barbara Zucker School of Medicine of Hofstra University and Northwell Health, Timothy Brown of UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Uday Grewal of Emory University School of Medicine. The oncologists talked about the most profound gastrointestinal abstracts in colorectal cancer, neuroendocrine tumors, and upper GI cancer from the 2025 ESMO Congress. Ranging from Matterhorn to Aspen to Foxtrot and Niche 2, the conversation covered the most recent practice-changing data in GI cancer.
You know, I feel like to start things off, it's probably best to start with things that matter the most and are practice impacting. So maybe, Tim, do you want to kick it off and we start talking about like the upper GI trial of the conference?
Yeah, I think, you know, we had the final analysis of Matterhorn, which was much awaited. You know, Matterhorn was the phase 3 double-blind study, randomized patients 1-to-1, FLOT to durvalumab and FLOT followed by a durvalumab maintenance period. It should be familiar to everybody here on the call, but this was one of the ASCO plenary sessions. At ASCO, we had the EFS results, the event-free survival results, which favored the addition of durvalumab to perioperative FLOT, and it was simultaneously published in the New England Journal. However, the overall survival analysis at ASCO was an interim analysis, and although the p-value was 0.03 with a hazard ratio of 0.67, it missed the significance threshold for the interim analysis, which was set at p of less than 0.0001. And so although it looked promising, it was not quite significant. So at ESMO on, I believe it was Friday, we had the final OS analysis of Matterhorn, and it did live up to expectations. The final analysis showed an overall survival hazard ratio of 0.78 with a p-value of 0.021. So this, I believe, you know, we'll seal durvalumab and FLOT as the standard of care for resectable gastric and GEJ cancers. The interesting things about this is that it looks like the benefit is largely being driven by the PD-L1 positive group.
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah. So tomorrow you have a PD-L1 less than 1% show up. Are you giving them the D, which in this case is durvalumab?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's something that you have to offer. The study was not adequately powered to say definitively that there's no benefit in the PD-L1 negative group, and this was a small proportion of the, you know, of the patients that were enrolled. So I think it's going to be standard across the board, regardless of PD-L1 expression. Although we can argue,
is it worth checking PD-L1 if you're, you know, slam dunk all comers?
I mean, we're still checking it on everybody. So I think it's useful for advanced line planning. But I guess it remains to be seen how the FDA is going to look at this and how the NCCN will look at it.
Yeah, I mean, if you remember, there was originally an approval for, I think, what was it, metastatic HER2 positive
yep.
Gastric, and the original approval was for all comers, and then it was later amended to be greater than 1%. Uday, what do you think? Everyone gets durvalumab, or only the greater 1%?
Yeah, I think I would agree with Tim. It's really going to be very hard to say that we should restrict this to PD-L1 positive tumors. We know that in the metastatic setting, there's a strong correlation between PD-L1 positivity and benefit of immunotherapy when it's added to cytotoxic chemotherapy. But the data here, I mean, 10% patients had PD-L1 negative tumors. If you look at the hazard ratios, pretty similar, of course, for the PD-L1 negative cohort, the confidence interval is pretty wide. So I don't think you can fault someone for offering this, and I think that should be the case. But I would definitely say I would tell my patients that the magnitude of benefit might not be the same, but I'm definitely going to offer it.
Yeah, I'm probably more of an anti, less than 1%. It has a ratio goes from 0.79 to, you know, like 1.4, something like that, clearly crossing one. I mean, I'm not seeing many of these patients now upper GI, but I would probably be not as inclined to offer it. Yeah. But we're, you know, we're 7 minutes in, we're getting through one study so far. You want to jump to something in your neck of the woods, Uday, something netty, perhaps?
Sure. I think for the longest time, we have been looking at the lack of prospective data for surgical resection in neuroendocrine tumors. And we had this labor of love that was presented by Dr. Stefano Partelli. This was the Aspen study that was a prospective study of 1,000 patients with non-functioning pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors less than 2 centimeters. And the standard of care so far has been that we watch these patients, but there's been arguments like, should we watch everyone? Should there be some patients that undergo surgical resection? So in this cohort, 87% of the patients actually pursued active surveillance, and those with larger tumors had more chances of pursuing surgery. When they looked at outcomes, they noted that overall survival was similar between active surveillance and surgery, and only 18% patients had relevant tumor growth at 7 years. And they also showed that occurrence of metastatic disease in these patients is rare. To me, the most striking data in this study is that the number needed to treat was 289 and the number needed to harm was 6. So I think this really settles a debate whether or not to surgically operate on patients with size less than 2 centimeters, and shows that active surveillance is a safe option for these patients with pancreatic nets less than 2 centimeters and non-functional nets.
And to be clear, these were like low grade nets. So like if somebody comes mm-hmm. across, you know, a 2 centimeter small cell, probably good to do something about that, right?
Absolutely. And then follow that up with adjuvant chemotherapy.
Yeah. So these are low grade, tiny nets. And, you know, this comes up in tumor board all the time. I can't think of a week when somebody doesn't mention something like this, but it's really nice to have this type of data ready for incorporation into clinical practice tomorrow, you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is the strongest data we have and answers the question beautifully.
Tim, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I don't see a ton of these patients. And, you know, I think it makes sense if you can prevent a patient from having a surgery for something that's not going to cause them harm in the long run. I think this is really valuable data to support that stance.
Nice. Well, maybe we should jump to something in colorectal land where I'm most comfortable. I mean, there have been a bunch of studies that we could talk about in terms of things that change practice tomorrow. You know, this is an analysis that's kind of been seen before, just in a new light. This was the Foxtrot versus Niche 2 analysis. For people that don't remember, Foxtrot was a study that did neoadjuvant chemotherapy for patients, including MSI high. And Niche 2 was one where they used one dose of neoadjuvant nivolumab, nipilimumab, followed by one dose of nivolumab. That patients then went on to curative intent resection with MSI high tumors. And basically what they're doing is comparing across these two trials, the MSI high population from Foxtrot and that in Niche 2. And what they showed is in the Niche 2 regimen for MSI high, there was 99% pathologic response, 67% pathologic CR, and zero recurrences to date at 3 years, which is just like a wild finding. I feel like overnight this should change the standard of care, even if the FDA hasn't caught on yet. But at least from my perspective, if I find out about an MSI high patient before they go to the OR, I'm probably running with ipi/nivo at them. Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but yeah, it seems like a no-brainer.
I think that's the challenge, what you just said right there, is intercepting these patients before they go to the OR. What's your strategy and what's your environment like when you're at tumor board? Are you seeing a lot of these patients being identified as MSI high before the OR, or is it mostly after they've already been resected?
Yeah, so Northwell Health is pretty huge. They have hundreds of colorectal patients every year that get diagnosed across 10 different cancer centers. And the tumor boards I show up to, all of the surgeons know, we got to screen these patients. We need to reach out if they're MSI high. We get the testing back before we go to the OR. And that's working really nicely. It's the satellite centers. I literally had a call today about somebody who said, oh, I've got, you know, all of my patients come already resected. I don't know about them beforehand. So what we're doing is I'm designing these machine learning algorithms that are identifying patients as they're diagnosed, as their pathology is coming in. And basically, the goal is to help people make the right decisions, make sure the right things are ordered instead of in terms of biomarker testing, so we can pick those patients out and potentially just help improve what we're already, you know, doing well, which is to screen people and get them to see medical oncology before they hit the OR. But that's what we're kind of piloting now and hoping to spread across the different satellite facilities within Northwell.
Yeah, that's a major challenge. It's going to take a big culture shift, but it's definitely worth it with these sorts of outcomes that you're seeing with very limited treatment in comparison to the 6 months of FOLFOX or whatever.
Yeah. So Uday, the follow-up, I guess, is do you send these patients to surgery? Let's say you have a rectal patient. We have the CIRSIC data as well. Like, is if you have a patient, they're doing well with scans, CTD negative, are they going to the OR, or are you saying maybe we should watch and wait?
I think in my experience, I've laid out both the options for patients. You know, at the end of the day, it's a patient that, you know, gets to have 100% control over this decision. But in my experience, majority of these patients, once they know that they've achieved a clinical complete response, they've chosen not to go to the OR and pursue watch and wait, which makes sense.
Yeah, it's exciting times when we can give a medication cure a solid tumor. Like, that to me is one of the best parts of being an oncologist, is we can see in real time how treatments are changing, and we're going from a time when it was surgery and pray for the best to, you know, some additional therapies, and now finally to, okay, I've got a biologic for this, and potentially we can totally avoid surgical resection. So I guess driving back to upper GI, where do you want to go to next, Tim?
Well, I think we have to address Fortitude 101. I mean, that was a study that people were looking forward to. This was the study that looked at bemarituzumab, which was the FGFR2B monoclonal antibody in combination with FOLFOX versus placebo versus FOLFOX. And it was touted, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, maybe 2 months or so ago, we got the top line results from Amgen, where they mentioned that it met its primary endpoint of improving overall survival. And so we were all very excited about this frontline gastric and GEJ space becoming even more crowded based off of biomarker-driven treatment. And while the initial primary analysis was significant, they did an interim analysis that looked at overall survival and found a difference between the addition of bemarituzumab with 17 and a half months overall survival versus 12 and a half months with placebo. They went on to do a descriptive analysis, which is the final analysis. And although there are no statistics that are associated with it, the median OS turned out to be 14 and a half versus 13.2 months.
That sounds less of a difference.
Yeah, so it definitely, with further follow-up, the way that it was sold is with further follow-up, the difference becomes attenuated. And so, you know, while this was important and it shows the feasibility of targeting FGFR2B, it looks like this combination is not going to be it. And so there's a follow-up study, Fortitude 102, which is going to combine FOLFOX with bemarituzumab with immunotherapy for the appropriate patients, which will hopefully build upon, you know, our CheckMate 649 data and this Fortitude 101 data.
So it's kind of tough, right? You know, it goes to show that you can't just take the top line press result that comes out before the conference. And, you know, honestly, like, this is just a very good example of you got to wait for the data to come out and the actual results to be finalized. Uday, any thoughts?
Yeah, honestly, even if this would have been positive, I was a little concerned about that control arm with just FOLFOX. And how would I bring this to my clinic and offer it to my patients when I don't know how this would do compared to FOLFOX and nivolumab? I mean, you could talk about like the PD-L1 thresholds, but we know that this has been long the standard of care now. And also, like Tim said, with the bemarituzumab and ICI with chemotherapy, I'm not sure if we see improvement in overall survival there, how much of that would truly be driven by bemarituzumab, unless there's like a very strong translational rationale of combining the two agents, which I'm not sure there is.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I will say I'm glad that we're not going to have to manage the corneal adverse events associated with FGFR inhibition for a little while longer here in the upper GI space.
That's probably fair. I, you know, having prescribed some of these IDH1 inhibitors, it's, yeah, not so fun. So Uday, you touched on Aspen, kind of a non quasi-interventional study, surgery or no surgery. Any interventional studies in NETS that you think are important to go over?
Absolutely. I'm really excited about belzutifan in pheochromocytoma and paraganglioma metastatic based on the LITESPARK-015 international phase 2 trial. Just as a reminder, as most of us would be aware, the FDA did approve belzutifan, which is a selective HIF-2 alpha inhibitor for patients with PPGL in May this year. This was a trial that included 72 patients with advanced metastatic PPGL and showed a 26% objective response rate and 85% disease control rate. And the median progression-free survival is pretty impressive, 22 months, and 76% patients were alive at 24 months. What's really important to note here is also that about one third of these patients noted reduction in antihypertensive use by more than 50%, which truly speaks to the ability of this agent to achieve improved catecholamine control. And overall, it was pretty well tolerated. Anemia is expected because of the inhibition of HIF-2 alpha, and grade 3 anemia was seen in about 22% patients. But overall, pretty impressive data, a new treatment option for these patients. I'm pretty excited. I've already actually treated a couple patients on clinical trials and one patient off-label because of a germline VHL.
So I think you already answered my question, but ready for clinic tomorrow.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right. Well, that's exciting. Tim, anything to add for belzutifan?
No, very, very promising mechanism of action and really reassuring outcome data here. I think this makes sense for this uncommon patient population.
Yeah. Well, making sure we have time just because this, you know, was one of the presidential presentations, but STELLAR-303 probably definitely is worth mentioning. So this was Zanza TKI by Exelixis plus atezolizumab versus regorafenib in refractory metastatic colorectal cancer. So this was a large phase 3 trial that ran over a few years. And they had finally their analysis come out, I think today. So Anwar Saeed presented it, but it showed a statistically significant improvement in overall survival with Zanza Atezo in microsatellite stable colon cancer versus regorafenib. The overall survival was about 11 months versus 9.4 months, led to a hazard ratio of 0.8, and that was significant. They had a subgroup analysis, so patients who did not have liver mets, and if you know colon cancer, you know patients without liver mets tend to respond better to immunotherapy. But in this subpopulation, they showed that the overall survival was 16 months versus 12.7. So a similar hazard ratio, which was a little bit surprising. I think a lot of people expected that to be better. The other thing to mention, grade 3 and above adverse events, 60% versus 37%. So it did seem like Zanza Atezo really did bump up the toxicity for these patients. So this was a positive study. I think time will tell how this is going to be worked into the guidelines and practice patterns of people, across the country. It's a little bit of a tough sell. 0.8 hazard ratio does seem like there's benefit, but increased toxicity for a patient population that's frankly going through a lot already. What do you guys think? Is this something you're going to reach for in the clinic if it's available, if it's approved?
I do want to add about the toxicity. You know, we see this about with most TKIs. You look at HCC, lenvatinib, cabozantinib. We see that in neuroendocrine tumors. In the cabinet study, most patients got 60. I'm yet to treat someone with 60, except the one patient that we treated on cabinet. So I think in real world practice, we're probably going to step up. We're probably going to dose reduce up front, and the tolerability is going to be better.
Yeah, I think this is an exciting combination. It makes sense from a mechanism of action standpoint. I will say, and I understand why they use regorafenib as a control arm, when this was being designed, that was appropriate. But one thing we are going to have to watch in the future is making sure our control arms actually reflect everyday practice. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a lot of competing, third line regimens without clear signal of which one is the go-to after failure of FOLFOX and FOLFIRI.
Yeah, I think I'm burying the lead here. I'm pretty bullish on Seller 303. I think it's going to be something that we're going to see in the clinic. I think that the major benefit of it is it's really unlocking an era where we're going after microsatellite stable cancers with immunotherapy. And I think this is the start. I think that we're going to have new regimens and strategies, whether that uses Zanza plus other agents for something else. I think it's something that we're going to see more of. And I'm just excited that people are exploring it in a broad way. Because at the end of the day, if we can figure out how to harness immunotherapy for microsatellite stable tumors, I think we're going to see a whole lot of improvement for patients.
I'm okay. With you on that, Nick. And I think most of the progress that we've made in the recent years for microsatellite stable colorectal cancer has been incremental progress. It's not been like slam dunk, home run, and we've cured colorectal cancer. And I truly think that, I mean, I see Tim's point about regorafenib, but I think it's in that refractory space, it's probably not the worst control arm. And we know that even with redose, regorafenib is a horrible drug for patients to tolerate. So it's really nice to have something that's better than regorafenib.
Yeah. I mean, every week I'm faced with, okay, I've got Lonsurf, I've got Rego, I've got fruquintinib, and all of them have black box warnings and other significant toxicities. So this is just something that's a little bit different. Tim, I feel like there's probably some things floating around in upper GI HCC land. I don't know if you or Uday want to talk about any, like CARES, for example.
Sure, I can talk about CARES. This was a phase 3 trial, randomized, comparing camrelizumab and rivaceranib versus surgery alone in patients with resectable HCC. They only included patients with child PUA, and these patients were treatment naive.
Before you get too far in, what is camrelizumab and rev? I can't even say it.
So this is an immune checkpoint inhibitor, PD-L1, and rivaceranib is a VEGF TKI. So pretty standard, like, systemic therapy combination. I think these are Chinese drugs, so not FDA approved in the U.S. So they wanted to look at event-free survival as a primary endpoint, and secondary endpoint was overall survival and pathological response rate and RCO resection. What they saw was a clear improvement in event-free survival. The median EFS was 42.1 months compared to 19.4 months with surgery alone. And I think this is a pretty clear signal of clinical benefit. They also noted that major pathological response was seen in about 35% patients and 7.5% patients with surgery alone. About 3% patients even achieved a complete pathological response and no new safety signals. I think overall the trial really reiterates where the field is headed, both for HCC and cholangiocarcinoma. We're moving towards, this new era of new adjuvant therapy.
I mean, it seems like a lot of tumors are moving there. Non-small cell beats everyone to the punch, like always, and we're moving that way towards bladder urothelial cancers. Who knows, maybe one day colon cancer will get there. Rectal certainly has. Tim, you've got a few minutes left, and honestly, if there's any questions, we're happy to answer them. But Tim, anything else you think's really important up top?
Yeah, one thing we saw was the FIRFLOT study, which was to best of my knowledge, the first study in HER2 positive resectable gastric cancer. And basically, this study combined pembrolizumab and trastuzumab in combination with perioperative FLOT, followed by a period of pembrolizumab and trastuzumab maintenance. And it bumped up the, it was a small study, only 30 patients enrolled, but it bumped up the PATH CRs up to 48.4%, which I think is pretty typical of what we see in the metastatic setting. High rates of diarrhea, 38.7%, and there are no outcomes that have been presented. But this is a very intriguing study that I think builds upon the concepts that Matterhorn laid out, but targeting HER2 in a what appears to be successful manner. So my main question about this is, you know, will this translate to a DFS and OS benefit? It's a single arm study, but the numbers have to look right. And then logistically, will this be acceptable to patients? It can be difficult to line up FLOT with Pembro and Trastuzumab for sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the march of biologics that are moving from refractory metastatic to first line metastatic, and now to the locally advanced resectable era. So, you know, I think we'll see these HER2 agents start coming in more and more into GI medical oncology in earlier settings. So, you know, this kind of fits. You know, basically out of time now. If there's any questions, we can stay on for a few more minutes and answer them. I guess I'll comment on Dynamic 3. So this was a study that was already presented earlier this year. There's some additional analysis now, but Dynamic 3 was a ctDNA-guided adjuvant de-escalation after surgery for stage 3 colon cancer patients. It was about 1,000 patients, 700 of which ended up getting ctDNA, and they were either randomized to ctDNA-adapted versus standard chemo. The ctDNA-adapted had drastically lower oxaliplatin use of 35% versus 89%, as you might think that, you know, most people would get it otherwise. And the three-year relapse free survival was pretty similar, 85% versus 88%, but non-inferiority wasn't met, which was about an 8% margin. So there was lower toxicity, so grade 3 and above adverse events, 6 versus almost 11%, lower hospitalizations. And if you really look at the lower risk category, the T1 to 3N1 subgroup, their outcomes were nearly identical. So I had a patient today, they were an N2, but they mentioned de-escalation in this way. And for them, I really wasn't as enthusiastic, but the next time I see a T1 to 3N1, I don't know. I feel like I'm going to have to think very hard. I don't know if it's ready for prime time yet, but you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know what I think about ctDNA monitoring in GI cancers, but again, not quite ready for prime time. We have more data, not certain what to do with it or how it impacts practice, but at least we're starting to get some outcomes.
I'm definitely with Tim on that. You know, we all see a lot of patients with colorectal cancer, of course, but we're not like a colorectal investigator like Nick. So I look at it also from like a patient perspective. It's really hard to make sense of the data so far, and it becomes really challenging to educate patients on the use of ctDNA and what it really stands for. And I think with all these new data emerging, it's great, but I think it still doesn't answer the question, what does it really stand for and what's the clinical implication of ctDNA?
We're still waiting for that moment when it really shines. Well, I appreciate you guys taking the time to chat about this and everyone else for tuning in. But went through some good studies, and you know, all of us are always around to answer any questions or if anyone wants to talk about some nerdy science stuff in the future.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the Journal of Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancernetwork.